With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. Farm Bureau delegation makes their voices heard on Capitol Hill. A delegation of California Farm Bureau leaders held meetings to advocate on important issues facing farmers and ranchers as debate continued in Congress over how to fund the federal government. Farm Bureau leaders and the organization's federal policy team met in the nation's capital on September 10th through the 13th. Discussions focused on important agricultural issues such as the next federal farm bill and the need for prompt relief funding to recover from disasters, including flooding and wildfires. That was today's California Farm Bureau Food and Farm News Report, and now let's get into today's show headlines. Farmers Union supports Right to Repair Bill. The Agricultural Right to Repair Act was introduced in both the House and Senate, and the legislation is strongly supported by the National Farmers Union. NFU President Rob LaRue says the Right to Repair Act is an important step in the fight to ensure farmers across the country have fair and affordable access to the parts, tools, and information they need to fix farm equipment. He says, quote, "I want to thank the officials who introduced the bill to guarantee farmers the right to repair their equipment," adding, "NFU stands ready to help push this bill forward." Right to Repair is a pillar of NFU's Fairness for Farmers campaign to address the monopoly crisis in agriculture. Just three manufacturers control the majority of farm equipment production, sales, and repairs, and use software locks to prevent farmers and independent mechanics from completing certain repairs. Right to Repair could save farmers $4.2 billion every year. NAFB contributed to that report, and now here's AgNet West Brian German with more agriculture news.
The Sustainable Pest Management Roadmap for California seeks to move away from certain pesticides and management approaches through a variety of different actions. Director of the California Department of Pesticide Regulation, Julie Henderson, said they're looking to leverage existing areas of funding to support the roadmap's implementation.
We at the department have funding for integrated pest management grants that focus on both research that develops alternatives as well as alliance grants that fund outreach and education that support implementing sustainable pest management practices. So the planning will involve both using existing resources to help get the roadmap implementation started as well as identifying future implementation needs. Another near-term goal will be for us at the department to develop the priority pesticide process.
Researchers are looking at the efficacy of a variety of materials most often used to manage powdery mildew in strawberries. Field research manager at the Cal Poly Strawberry Center, Kyle Blauer, described how he's been conducting the research trials.
We do it in the greenhouse instead of the field because powdery mildew lacks that high humidity protected by the greenhouse environment. So we're able to get really high pressure, whereas our non-treated control can be up as high as like 80% incidence. So really high number of leaves that are infected with powdery mildew. And with that high pressure, we're able to separate from the non-treated control. So there's 5 weekly sprays. And then after this, we're evaluating the foliage to see how much mildew is on the leaves. And in this trial, I was looking at the top 10 most commonly applied fungicides for controlling powdery mildew. I got that information from looking at the pesticide use reports from Santa Barbara County over the past 3 years, just focusing on strawberries. And so it gave me a list of, you know, what was being used. And I kind of throw those all into the same trial to see their efficacy. And there was a wide range of efficacy with majority of the products significantly separating from the non-treated control, but there were a couple that didn't separate. And I think we'll look at that again because that was the first time we had looked at these products, but we want to confirm those results by testing them again in next year's season. And to really talk about the materials would be kind of hard over the phone, so I'd recommend for people to take a look at the handouts that we have posted online if they have additional questions.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Thanks, Brian, and stay tuned as we'll have more of the day's agriculture news and farm features here on the AgNet News Hour. Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search our name of AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet West. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
And now, another episode of One Soil to Live.
All right,
Let's take a look, Claude. I see you've been keeping it covered.
Yes, I have.
And it appears you haven't disturbed it.
Well, I've tried really hard not to.
You're using living roots throughout the year with diverse species in rotations, right?
Just exactly as you prescribed, Doctor.
Well, I'll have to say I'm impressed with your organic matter, aggregation, and microbial activity. Claude, I'm happy to report that your soil is fit as a fiddle.
Oh, thank you. I guess it's true that soil health management systems are just what the doctor ordered.
I couldn't have said it better myself.
Improving soil health can make your farm more productive, profitable, and resilient. Visit your local USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service office today and learn more about the basics and benefits of soil health. This message brought to you by USDA and this radio station.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, Senator Rick Scott, a Republican from Florida, tried to take his disaster relief bill to the Senate floor last week, noting that it contained a block grant for agriculture.
What they also told me is there's a community in every state in this country that's getting impacted by the FEMA disaster relief fund. So I've been trying for months to get a vote on a bill, which is pretty common sense. Number one, it'll put funds into FEMA so they can provide help in, for all these communities in every state. Number two, the next thing it does is helps our farmers. Our farmers in Florida have been waiting for almost 12 months for relief from the Department of Agriculture. Historically, what the Department of Agriculture did, especially when I was governor, what they did was they would provide a block grant to the state to our farmers so the money could get out to our farmers quicker. For whatever reason, Secretary Vilsack, Secretary of Ag, has decided now that he has to have a separate legislation from Congress that gives him specific authority that he can do a block grant. It's never happened before, but whatever reason, he believes it has to happen now. That's in this bill. The Army Corps of Engineers is a key partner in beach renourishment in any state that's impacted. I know our presiding officer had wildfires, and I'm sure their beaches have had some impact. So it would also help our Army Corps of Engineers help with beach renourishment and also help our military installations after a disaster. So mine is a common sense bill. It impacts some community in every state in the country. And so what I'm asking for is a standalone vote on my bill, which is called the Federal Disaster Responsibility Act. And I hope every senator here will unanimously agree that we should do this. As if in legislative session, I ask unanimous consent that the Finance Committee be discharged from further consideration of S-2721 and the Senate proceed to its immediate consideration. I further ask that Scott Ribbio's substitute amendment at the desk be considered and agreed to, the bill as amended be considered read a third time, and the Senate vote on passage of the bill as amended with a 60-vote affirmative threshold required for passage of the bill.
The bill would have set up a Senate vote on a proposal to add more than $16 billion to the Federal Emergency Management Agency's Disaster Relief Fund, which is projected to have $550 million left in its account by month's end. However, the senator from Rhode Island, Democrat Sheldon Whitehouse, blocked the attempt with an objection.
The warning signs of another 2008-scale financial crisis are already flashing red, and behind those immediate warning signs looms the collapse of Earth's basic natural operating systems that science has predicted for decades and with real precision. We need to do a lot more than just clean up. We do need to clean up the disasters, but we also need to get the pre-disaster preparation and resources in because we know this is coming and we know it's getting worse. And we absolutely need to head off the root cause of all of this, which is fossil fuel emissions, choking our atmosphere with greenhouse gases, heating up the earth and causing us to spin out from basic conditions of habitability of the earth that have existed for tens of thousands of years. So what we should do is pass the continuing resolution with full funding for the President's supplemental request for FEMA's disaster relief fund, for the Department of Agriculture firefighter money, for the Department of Interior firefighter money. And while we're at it, because President Zelensky was here today, I'll also add that it's really important to continue to support Ukraine. So for those reasons, I will object.
Meanwhile, the fiscal year ends at the end of this week, and the current Farm Bill along with it. That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's livestock report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, with fall here, many cattle producers are wondering what to expect for the final few months of the year. AgNet Media's Will Jordan talked with a Cattle Facts representative about their outlook for the remainder of 2023.
As hints of cooler weather are beginning to appear, the heat of cattle prices remains steady. Looking into the fall, marketing calves is on the minds of many producers. To help inform marketing decisions, AgNet visited with Holden Rainey, cattle market analyst from Cattle Facts, for a fall cattle market forecast.
So, as far as the calf market here, going into this fall, really should continue to, fall's typically a weaker time for the calf market, but seasonally, we expect it to be quite a bit more steady this year as we go through that time frame, just because supplies have been so tight. On a U.S. basis, I'm expecting calf prices, on a U.S. basis for a 550-pound steer to continue to trade above that $300 level.
Looking at bred cattle pricing.
So I think that maybe expansion takes place a little slower than what we were initially would have expected, especially early on in the summer when a lot of those areas like Texas were getting rain. It's just been really dry. In August, the U.S. average bred cow price was running about on top of 2,000 is what our data would show. Probably should stay in that 2,000 to 2,100 range. Seasonally, the 20-year index does suggest that you soften up a little bit through September and October and then start to go higher. Right now, you're probably pretty well supported at 2,000 on the low side, but probably could, see 2,100 to, maybe 2,150 here as we get into the later end of the fall and early winter. Like I said, that's going to be definitely impacted by moisture.
For AgNet West, this is Will Jordan.
Thanks, Will. And lawmakers have reintroduced the Rural Veterinary Workforce Act. It was formerly known as the Veterinary Medicine Loan Repayment Program Enhancement Act. Introduced in both the House and Senate, the legislation would expand its reach. Now, the program will help increase access to food, animal, veterinary services in rural areas by assisting with the significant obstacle of educational debt. The legislation would end the federal taxation on awards, enabling more veterinarians to participate in a program that offers up to $75,000 over 3 years for student loan repayment in exchange for service in USDA-designated shortage areas. This year, the USDA declared some 237 rural veterinary shortage areas in 47 states. American Veterinary Medical Association President Dr. Rena Carson said, "We look forward to working with the congressional champions to enact this bill and help rural communities across the country access the many essential services that veterinarians provide." I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them, just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
The USDA is expanding its effort to prevent food waste. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. The Department of Agriculture has announced an additional $25 million investment to expand efforts to prevent and reduce food loss and waste. The investment, which is funded under the American Rescue Plan Act, is part of a joint agency initiative between USDA's National Institute of Food and Agriculture and USDA's Office of the Chief Economist. More than one-third of all available food goes uneaten through loss or waste. The funding will support the Community Food Project's competitive grants program to reduce food loss and waste, also to get surplus wholesome food to individuals and develop linkages between food producers, providers, and food recovery organizations. Since 2017, NIFA has committed $123.5 million across 527 projects related to food loss and waste. This latest investment will expand several of their core programs by $25 million. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCohen. USDA data shows that about one-third of the nation's farmers are over age 65. Two-thirds are over age 55, and about 25% of farms will transition to new ownership in the next few years. But many haven't planned for that transition. So what keeps farm and ranch families from doing estate planning? What keeps farm and ranch families from getting started on an estate or succession plan? There are many reasons, but here are a few of the common ones. Many people don't get a plan done simply because they don't know where to start. One way to not get started is to try to start by figuring out what's fair. Fairness is subjective. Also, don't be concerned about someone being angry at your decisions. You're making a decision for the transition of a business, so keep your plan tied to your goals. Also, don't keep putting planning off. You don't know how much sand is left in the top of your hourglass. Keep cost in perspective. For many plans, the cost will be under $10,000. What's your farm's legacy worth? And don't think that you can just let your children figure it out after you're gone. If you do that, you'll likely be letting a judge figure things out. Farm and ranch estate and succession planning can be complex, but don't let that prevent you from getting started on a plan. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCohen.
In honor of National Suicide Prevention Month, UPL is committed to reminding growers about the benefits of mental and physical well-being out on the farm, especially as harvest is now underway for most. Kathy Dothag, an extension professional in the School of Social Work at the University of Missouri Extension Service, says prioritizing your health is more important now than ever.
Particularly at this time of the year, it's harvest time. Lots of stress. There's lots of things going on in families, back to school, new sports, too many kids and too many different things. And of course, the things that we can't prioritize are the things that we can't control. What we need to do is to think about what works best for the individuals and for their families, like get up perhaps a bit earlier when it might be a quiet time, getting off the tractor or the combine just for a quick break, just working those kinds of things, really paying close attention to our bodies.
She talks about warning signs of mental and physical distress that growers and their families should look out for. It's important to remember that those signs involve significant changes in behavior.
If individuals are sleeping too much or not sleeping, if they're eating or drinking too much or not eating, are they more irritable? Do they, if you will, fly off the handle more quickly? Is there a change in their mood? Another thing that's incredibly important, and that's to think about isolation. Are they not doing things they used to be doing? Like, do they go to the coffee shop once a week or so? Are they usually going to church or to some kind of organization? They've quit doing that. So we're really looking at changes in behavior.
It's so important for growers feeling stressed, anxious, or even suicidal to talk to someone.
There's a wonderful option that we have that has just gone into effect. In fact, we're right now at the 1-year anniversary, and that's 988. It is the Suicide and Crisis Prevention Line. It's going to be video, so individuals will be able to, if they are hearing impaired, will be able to use that 988 line. You can text, you can call an individual who's expressing a crisis or just wants to talk to somebody or is just not feeling well and wants to talk to somebody. So they're trained counselors. If you're a family member or if you have a friend that you're worried about, you can call that 988 number.
The University of Missouri has several resources that farmers in and outside of Missouri can access.
We have several farm and ranch stress grants that allow us to provide classes, sessions for farmers and their families, for people who work with farmers. We have all kinds of written resources. There's a really good website, Show Me Strong Farm Families, that has lots of good information. information on it. One of the grants that we have is a multi-state. There are 12 states are involved, and so we collaborate to bring the best of the best so that we can provide those to all individuals, farmers, ranchers, and their farm families.
For more information, go to extension.missouri.edu. Chad Smith reporting.
As the Senate focuses on votes to confirm presidential nominees, some senators continue to push for a focus on the budget. U.S. Senator John Corinne of Texas voiced his thoughts on the budget delay on the House floor Wednesday and pointed out that appropriations bills still have not gone to votes.
Congress, which is required to fund the government by passing appropriations bills, has not passed a single appropriation bill 10 days before the end of the fiscal year.
He put pressure on the Senate and said shutting down the government is not a good solution.
Shutdowns harm innocent people and create needless uncertainty for our economy.
No action has been taken this week on the farm bill, which, like others, expires next week at the end of the fiscal year on September 30th. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
Keeping an eye on a volatile livestock trade and stock market to start the week. I'm Mark Oppold with today's bottom line report brought to you by Helena and Kloss Equipment. The Kloss Treon 740 combine has been a big hit at fall farm shows. It's a Class 7 machine that proves bigger, not always better. Learn more at Kloss.com. The S&P 500 endured its worst week since mid-March last week, and the Dow will battle 34,000 here early week. The last time it traded below that level was July 7th. Bond yields continue at 15-year highs. All this and a weaker livestock trade, mostly a recalculation after the Federal Reserve indicated that more interest rates are coming in the fourth quarter. Crude oil starting over $91 a barrel. Gold futures are back near $2,000 an ounce. December live cattle support now 188.20 today. December lean hogs oversold in our view, $72 needs to hold here early week. That's our bottom line as we begin this last week of September. I'm Mark Oppold, wishing you a profitable day and a profitable week ahead.
An effort to develop, study, and potentially market a new form of agricultural production recently reached a milestone.
We started with 141 projects that were awarded tentatively resources under this initiative. The response was unbelievable from the farming community. We got over 1,000 applications.
And as the Partnerships for Climate Smart Commodities initiative concluded its first year, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack and others took time to assess progress to date on these efforts and what is expected in the coming weeks and years as work to incentivize climate-smart ag practices continue. I'm Rod Bain, and coming up, a look at year one of climate-smart commodity partnerships in this edition of Agriculture USA. It has been a year since USDA and Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack announced the initial round of projects supported through its Partnerships for Climate Smart Commodities Investments.
$2.8 billion utilized to finance 70 projects. We believe these 70 projects will enlist more than 50,000 farms across the United States.
Since that announcement, September of 2022, those large-scale projects were complemented by another series of smaller-scale climate-smart commodity projects at the end of last year. The final totals?
We're able to put together a fund of about $3 billion. These 141 projects are going to leverage private investment as well. Expect and anticipate that investment will be somewhere in the neighborhood of 50% of that amount. So this is really an over $4 billion effort.
These projects, these partnerships, are designed to promote climate-smart conservation practices, such as no-till, cover crops, and wetlands restoration, and in turn, produce commodities from these practices and develop markets for such.
Started as a voluntary market-driven incentive-based program because that's what farmers across the United States ask us to do. We want to know what works. We want to know how to do this. We're trying it now. We're trying the various aspects of it, but we really want to get down into the details.
An event in Wisconsin recognized the one-year anniversary of the initial funding announcement and allowed the secretary and participants to provide updates on both total program and individual project progress.
Around 90% of the contracts have entered into a specific signed agreement or in the process of executing the agreement, and we've now begun the exciting opportunity of reaching out to farmers, encouraging them to participate.
And diversity of these projects.
We were pleased that the 141 projects, basically all 50 states, all major commodities, specialty crops, the whole nine yards, organic, conventional ways of production. Exciting to see the diversity of American agriculture participate in this, crop production as well as livestock and all species.
As for illustrations of how Climate Smart commodity partnerships work, representatives from various efforts discuss the progress to date. Trust in Foods Project includes multiple organizations and institutions covering several states and focusing on 15 conservation practices in production of a wide range of commodities. According to Trust in Foods' Amy Scotchless Cole,
how can we use the information that's being made available, information that producers are sharing with us, to help individualize and customize program decisions, incentive decisions, technical assistance decisions, so that we are meeting each producer and each operation with the challenges that they face in their operation, rather than, say, treating every dairy farmer or every cattle rancher or every row crop grower the same?
So what lies ahead for the various projects within the Partnerships for Climate Smart Commodities Initiative past year one? The Agriculture Secretary says beyond signing contracts, recruiting farmers, and enrolling acreage.
We've also begun the process of having awardees begin the process of meeting. We've got quarterly meetings that have been set up, at which time there will be some sharing of information and best practices. There will also, over the course of time, be a collection of data that will be made transparently available to folks so that we'll be able to tell folks what works and what doesn't work. And we're not just going to share and be transparent with this information here within the U.S. We also feel an obligation to do this from a global perspective. So we have established what we call an international climate hub. It's a virtual tool that we'll use where we'll be able to take information and stories from this Climate Smart initiative and basically tell the world about what U.S. farmers, ranchers, and producers are doing.
More information about USDA's Partnerships for Climate Smart Commodities is available online at www.usda.gov. Click the Priorities tab on the homepage, then the Climate Solutions link. This has been Agriculture USA. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
October 12th is National Farmers Day, a time dedicated to those who wake before the sun rises and often work until long after it sets. Thanks to farmers' tireless efforts, we have the food, feed, fiber, and fuel we need here in America and plenty more for export. Best of all, farmers produce all of this sustainably so that future generations can have the same bounty. Today and every day, please join Syngenta in honoring the men and women of American agriculture.
Welcome back to the show. For today's interview segment, I'm tossing it right on over to our friends over at the Vineyard Team, where podcast host Craig McMillan talks all about managing the sour rot disease complex in grapes during their latest podcast episode.
Here with us today is Hans Walter Peterson. He is a viticulture extension specialist with the Finger Lakes Grape Program, part of Cornell Cooperative Extension. Thanks for being our guest today.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
You've been doing a lot of work on a situation, I'll call it, called sour rot on grapes. And that's what we're going to talk about today. Let's start with some basic definitions. What exactly is sour rot?
So sour rot is pretty much what it sounds like. It's one of the late season rots that can afflict grapes. Comes in after ripening starts. So much like botrytis, ripe rot, some of these other types of rots that growers might be familiar with. So it's another version of that. But it comes along with the bonus of acetic acid. Every rot kind of brings its own different compounds to the party. Sour rot brings one that really is not terribly welcome in winemaking, you know, essentially the main component of vinegar.
Yeah.
It's a particularly rough type of rot. We really are getting some more challenging years with it, past several years. So my program has really started to focus in on what we can do to try to keep it under control.
You know, I understand that part of the issue here is that sour rot is a disease complex. There's multiple actors involved in all of this. Can you tell us what some of those pieces are of that complex and how they interact to create sour rot?
Yeah, and it's probably the thing that makes sour rot a more difficult thing to manage than kind of the standard diseases, the regular diseases that most growers are used to dealing with, like powdery mildew, downy mildew, because those are developed by one type of microbe. So if you find the one thing that can control that one microbe, you've got a control measure. With sour rot, it's a, like you said, it's a complex of multiple organisms that bring it about. So basically there are yeasts. The yeasts get into the berries and take the sugar that's being developed in there, and they do exactly what we use yeast for in winemaking. Takes the sugar and turns it into alcohol. So we get a fermentation starting within the berries out in the vineyard. The second part of it that happens then is that there are bacteria that follow up and also arrive in there, most notably Acetobacter, but also some other things like Gluconobacter and Hansenia spora. This is some great work that was done by Wendy McFadden Smith in Ontario a number of years ago. So they all kind of come in and feast on that alcohol and convert that alcohol into acetic acid. So thereby there's the sour of sour rot. The piece that comes after that then is not just the sour rot, but then the thing that probably is really characteristic of it also, as with some of these other rots, but it spreads really quickly in a vineyard if the conditions are right. And that's mainly done by fruit flies. And it's not just the one that we've been hearing a lot about lately, the spotted wing Drosophila, the Drosophila suzukii, but it's also just your plain old Drosophila melanogaster, the ones used in your high school genetics classes or college genetics classes and see on your fruit around the sink and stuff like that. Those fruit flies, for the most part, mostly fruit flies, are a couple of other suspects in the mix too, but they're the ones that spread it from berry to berry and cluster to cluster and block to block.
Are they spreading the yeast, the bacteria, or both?
All of the above.
Okay, so that's it.
They're going to free ride. So that's the difficulty with it. If it was just, you know, like I was saying earlier, if it's something like black rot or botrytis, where it's just one single causal organism, that's one story, and that's hard enough to control. When you've got multiple types of organisms that aren't even directly related, I mean, yeast and bacteria are very different types of organisms, for example, we don't have a spray or a single thing that can control that. And so that's the real difficulty with managing it year in and year out.
So this just made me think of something. One way of thinking about disease complexes is if I can remove one of the element or two of the elements, I can at least reduce, if not prevent or treat, the disease. Is that the case with sour rot? If I had no bacteria, if I didn't have the yeast or something like that, can I get rid of one of them and help with this?
Yeah, that's a really good point. As I was saying earlier, you need the two microorganisms to cause the sour of the sour rot, the acetic acid development, but then you need a vector to move them through the vineyard, and that's the fruit flies. So if you can control the fruit flies, you have less chance for those microorganisms to move through the vineyard. If you create a less hospitable host for the microbes, there's less of them to be moved around by the fruit flies. So the management strategies that we're looking at are trying to come at it from both directions. Some of the original work that was done on this recently here at Cornell by a grad student, Dr. Megan Hall, who I believe you had on the show a while back.
I had on the show, and I know her, yes.
In Megan's original work here at Cornell, she basically found that it was somewhat more effective to control the fruit flies than to control the microbes. That just the microbes by themselves could cause a certain amount of rot, but then if you're controlling the fruit flies, it just, you don't get that explosive growth.
The fruit flies are the gasoline.
Right, exactly. Yeah, the microbes are the fuel, yes. So that was the impetus of kind of saying, okay, if you had to control just one thing, it's the fruit flies, because that's really where the explosive nature of the disease comes along. And it's a little bit easier to control a bug than it is microbes that are hiding inside the skins of berries and things like that.
Where do the microbes come from? Are they hanging out under the bark of the vine? Are they inside of shoots? Are they out in the environment and get blown on?
They're pretty ubiquitous in the environment. Talk about a lot about native fermentations and yeast coming in from the vineyard. So they're there and the bacteria are as well. I don't know some of the exact overwintering mechanisms. And if we know all about that, somebody probably does. I just don't. But it's my understanding is they're pretty native in our neck of the woods. They're there pretty much all the time.
Are there environmental conditions that are particularly conducive to promoting sour rot? And then also, are there environmental conditions that will prevent it or retard it?
So the big thing that gets sour rot going is for some way for the microbes to get into the berries in the first place. Predominantly in grapes, we think about that as either being insects, birds, or water. Here in the East, obviously, we get rain throughout the growing season, including during the harvest season. We have high humidity days plenty of times. And so those are the kinds of conditions where we see greater incidence of sour rot develop. When the vines take up water or the berries take up water, either through rainfall or just the atmosphere, and then the berries swell up, they can't handle all the water they have and they split. Or you have a very tight clustered variety that just the berries start getting forced apart and they just break by force. So those entry wounds, however they're caused, is how it gets started. So we know here in New York that if we have a dry fall, days with not many days with dew points above 70 and all those kinds of things, we don't see very much sour rot develop. We might see a little botrytis here and there, but for the most part, we don't see it. And a lot of that is because we just don't have the humidity to kind of build up the water in the berry to cause it to split. The years where we have it bad, on the contrary, that's when we see more water, more rainfall, more high humidity days, that's when we see more splitting and therefore more sour rot. Much like most other diseases, the warmer it gets, the faster it can progress. And the same thing with insects. The fruit flies at a lower temperature, it takes them longer for a next generation to develop. And so the warmer it gets, they get faster too. So yeah, so warm and wet.
So cool and dry would be the opposite, would be the desirable.
Yes, that would be best.
Actually, that just reminded me of something. My experience has all been on the Central Coast of California. This only happened once, and that was with some Pinot Noir that came in that had quite a lot of botrytis damage. And the winemaker had us go through and sort, and not simply sort out botrytis and throw it away, but by hand sort it and then smell it for sour. Is something like a botrytis or a scar from powdery mildew or something like that, is that also a possible entry for the organisms?
Yes. Very often we see botrytis and sour rot in the same cluster because it's the same thing. Botrytis is a very weak pathogen. It needs a place to kind of get established, like a wound. And so same thing with sour rot. We do know that, like you were just saying, powdery mildew scars can create micro fissures in the skin. And later on in the season, those can start to tear apart, even if you can't see them, especially around the pedicel near the stem where the stem connects to the berry. There can be micro fissures that those microorganisms can take advantage of as well. So those conditions are pretty similar for other kinds of rots as well.
Are there cultural practices or preventative or prophylactic practices that growers can use that might help manage this?
Yes. Probably the biggest one that we know of and we're trying to get a little bit better handle on as far as how to use it for this purpose. But we know that if you pull leaves before bloom, or right at the very beginning of bloom, you will reduce berry set. You basically kind of starve the clusters, the flowering clusters of carbohydrates and other nutrients, and so they don't set as many berries. You have a looser cluster. Those clusters don't swell up. They don't, like I was talking before, kind of force berries off. They dry out faster. All the good things we like about looser clusters. Pulling leaves at that very early, just pre-bloom or very early bloom stage can reduce berry set pretty consistently year in and year out, and help to reduce that cluster compactness aspect of rot development.
To listen to that full episode, visit vineyardteam.org. Stay tuned, we'll have more Ag News after the break.
Why do we have GMOs? Actually, we've been modifying crops for thousands of years to prevent crop loss from pest and weather damage, to grow more food on less land, even to improve nutrition. Today, GMOs are developed for the same reasons. With genetic engineering, scientists can change and improve crops more easily and quickly. Feed your mind with more GMO facts on FDA's website.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now. Agriculture Representative Roger Isom will now join the California Ag Leadership Foundation board. Isom has worked for the California Cotton Ginners and Growers Association since 1992 and the Western Agricultural Processors Association since 2009. He also has 31 years of regulatory and advocacy experience, specifically regarding environmental and safety matters. He was also recently named president of the Fresno State Ag One Foundation. CALF Board Chair Mike Young says, quote, "Roger will be a strong addition to our dedicated board. His insight, plus decades of experience in ag leadership in California, will benefit the foundation's success. His staff includes an Ag Leadership Program alum and a Class 52 fellow, so he understands the value of the program and fully supports the foundation's mission, vision, and values." The foundation just selected its new class of 24 individuals, and Isom will join 12 other CALF board members to direct the foundation. CALF President and CEO Dwight Ferguson says, quote, "The California Ag Leadership Foundation grows leaders who make a difference and go on to make a positive impact in their families, businesses, communities, and ultimately California agriculture. Participating program alumni assemble a diverse and inclusive class of fellows who represent a broad cross-section of our ag industry and the state's population. We're excited for the fellows to kick off their ag leadership journey next month." To learn more about the California Ag Leadership Foundation, visit agleaders.org.
Cal Poly and the California Department of Food and Agriculture, in partnership with California Climate Investments, is sponsoring a field tour of Cal Poly's Swanton Pacific Ranch. The event will offer an opportunity to hear from and discuss varying perspectives about how to improve rangeland management on California's Central Coast. The tour is scheduled to begin at noon on Friday, October 20th at Cal Poly's Swanton Pacific Ranch near Davenport. Presentations will cover rangeland soils and carbon sequestration and why site characteristics matter and how to better collaborate on and access financial incentive programs meant to improve carbon sequestration on ranches and farms. The tour of the operation will also feature a discussion about collaborative management of Swanton Pacific Ranch's rangeland with livestock. The deadline to register for the event is October 11th. More information about the field tour is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.